welcome to The Dividing Line on New Year's Eve. 2013 is the date, in case you hadn't already noticed. I certainly noticed it by just basically driving in today, and there was nobody on the roads, which is sort of nice, actually. But welcome to The Dividing Line at the end of the year. And I want to spend just a few minutes. Today we'll be talking a little bit about what happened in 2013. And also looking at some scriptural passages and some events of just recently as well, since that's on everybody's mind as well. So thanks for joining us today. This past Sunday, I haven't gotten these sermons up. Nobody who knew how to run the sound system at our church was at church on Sunday. Everybody was gone. So I actually have to take a cassette tape. Yes, do you remember cassette tapes? We still have a large supply of cassette tapes. I have to take a cassette tape and record it into digital to get the morning sermon. We actually did get that. And then I utilized my iPad to record Sunday evening. That's just how we had to do it this time around. And I haven't put up the sermons from this past Sunday at PRBC as of yet. I'm sure some people will take that as evidence of how PRBC is struggling. We'll talk about that a little bit later on, too. But anyway, I addressed a text of Scripture in light of the coming new year in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And I won't have time to go into, obviously, what I did in two sermons on Sunday, but I did want to at least start out with a positive note. The review of last year will be mainly positive as well before we talk about any negative things. But my attention was drawn to this text of 2 Corinthians because Paul, after speaking of the at the end of chapter 3, but we all with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed in the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit, that this incredible spiritual ministry of the new covenant that he has just described. And, of course, the fact that there is a veil lying over the minds of the unbelieving, that this is a spiritual issue. It is a the proclamation of the gospel is always a matter of spiritual warfare, and it is spiritually ascertained. There's everything to say properly about knowing the truth, being consistent in one's study of the Word of God, all these things. But when it comes down to it, the only way to have meaningful balance is to have the Spirit, to have the Word. This has been the teaching of God's people all along. You have to have the Spirit. You have to have the Word. They go together. So much of the problems is when you become imbalanced at that point. And so in that context, chapter 4, verse 1, therefore, since we have this ministry, as we received mercy, this ministry was given as an act of mercy. It's a tremendous term, the Greek term eleos, not just grace, but mercy. We do not lose heart. And I think that's sort of what captured my imagination. That and then the description of the gospel in verses 4 and 6 is what really, really grabbed my attention and why I stepped out of Hebrews long enough to do this particular set of sermons, which hopefully I'll have up within a few days. But two things. We do not lose heart. If you are like me, you look around and you see the acceleration of the degradation of our society. You see the acceleration, the degradation of what calls itself Christianity. You see apostasy all around us. We rejoiced last week. We rejoiced when on a secular talk show, they actually got a Christian on who said Christian things. We're like, yay! Because we're used to... Can you imagine what that Pierce Morgan thing would have been like if Joel Osteen had been in Michael Brown's spot? We all just would have been going, But that's what the way it was. We see those things, and we cannot help but in essence be troubled And when you see it every day, day in and day out, it can really cause you to lose heart. The Greek term that's used here is a term that refers to having a goal and then basically giving up on that goal. Too much opposition, too much in the way. You're heading one direction, you decide to take a little easier route, you know? Now, I've had that happen in my cycling career. I've been going out on a ride, and, you know, just some days you just, you know, the legs just aren't there. And, well, you know, I was going to go up that mountain there, but, yeah, this one over here is a little bit lower, a little bit easier to do. And you give up on your goal. Actually, this year, as long as I get a 25-mile ride in this afternoon, I will make my goal, Lord willing, if we can keep all the trucks and the crazy people away from me. And I will do it. But we all have a way of understanding what it means to lose heart in pursuing after a particular goal. And Paul said we don't. Why? Why? I think we have to know because I don't know about you. I don't mean to be a negative nanny. But I don't see any evidence of any brakes being applied by the Lord to this mad rush on the part of our society to self-destruction. I don't see any evidence of it. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen on January 2nd or something, but the reality is there only seems to be a greater and greater rejoicing in godlessness in our society. I mean, you know the passage from Paul. Whatever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report. Think about all that. You know, what is untrue is now celebrated. What is unjust is now celebrated. What is ugly is now celebrated. What is impure is now celebrated. That is what is going on. And once again, Psalm 12:8 is being lived out in front of us. The evil strut about when that which is vile is honored amongst men. And so how do we not lose heart? How did Paul not lose heart? I mean, he had not only all of that to face. Certainly Rome was no beautiful place to live at that time. But he had all of the, and this is really means something to me, even more so than when I preach these sermons, which is fascinating. He had all of this garbage to deal within the church. I mean, if anybody had a right to throw his hands up in the air and say, I'm just not dealing with all these people anymore, it would have been Paul. He could have said, look, I've been given divine revelation. I've been taken up to the third heaven. I've seen Jesus. I'm not going to deal with all these false teachers in Corinth that are trying to undercut my authority. I'm just going to leave it to somebody else. I'm too good for that kind of stuff. But he didn't. He knew he couldn't because the truth of the gospel was at stake. The health of the church, the very sanctity of the gospel and the message of the gospel and the preaching of the gospel and the ministry within the church, it was all part and parcel of what he had to deal with. And it could be easy to lose heart in light of how many falsehoods and how many unbelievers are inside the church pretending to be believers. Be real easy to lose heart. So why didn't he? Well, I need to know. And so I looked at it, and well, you see in verse 2, that last line, but by the manifestation of truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience, the sight of God, part and parcel of the way that Paul did that was he was absolutely honest in his proclamation. He didn't have to lie. He didn't have to cover over anything. He knew he had proclaimed the whole counsel of God, so there was no reason for him. He commended himself to every man's conscience in sight of God. He could say, I have done what I've done out of pure motives. That really helps, because when you don't have that kind of ability to honestly say that, it just eats at your soul. Just eats at your soul. When I think of certain people in the world today that I know cannot even look at themselves in the mirror, I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they keep going every day. Just don't know. But then he has to deal with the fact that, you know, if this if this New Covenant message is so glorious, from glory to glory there in 3:18, why is it that so few people believe it? Why is it even that the Jews in general reject what Paul is saying? Well, he says, even if our gospel is veiled, it's veiled those who are perishing. And that is the proper translation, despite what certain King James onlyists say, despite what some who promote a repentance-less gospel say, and there is no such thing. That's the proper terminology. It is those who are perishing. Tois apolumenois is a phrase that Paul uses elsewhere. He used it in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 when he says that our ministry is to those who are perishing. It's the stench of death. Stench of death. That's got to be a text. Maybe somebody could look it up if they have an extensive listing of all the sermons that Joel Osteen has ever preached. Has he ever preached on that one? Oh, how can... Yeah, guaranteed zero from the other room. I mean, how could you preach on that particular text while always smiling the whole time? It would be very hard. I don't think all the New Testament was meant to be read while smiling. I just don't think that. No, it doesn't work. Stench of death. The stench of death. That's strong words, Paul. Well, you just were so politically incorrect. Yeah, he was. He was. No joys about it. But those who are perishing, gospel's veiled. Those who are being saved, power of God. Same terminology used in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. So obviously it seems it was a particular element of the preaching that Paul had done in Corinth that he's reminding them of. Remember I talked about those who are perishing and those who are being saved. And they are present tense participles, and there is a reason why they're put the way they're being put. And so I just note that in passing. I'm not going to go into the issue of the case of the God of this world. You know that there's different views on that. Most people say it's Satan, and if that's the case, then Satan's being used instrumentally as a part of judgment. But there are others. There are a lot of people from the time of Augustine onward into the Middle Ages. They did not think that that was Satan. In fact, they sort of mistranslated it, to be honest with you. They understood it, in whose case God has blinded the minds of the unbelieving of the world. It's not really much of a possibility as to that reading, but I've mentioned to you that in modern days there has been a sort of rehabilitation, at least of the understanding, if not the reading, in light of John chapter 12. And the citation there of the judicial judgment of God. Which is really interesting, and someday we'll have to just do a whole thing on that. I've actually talked to the author of that particular paper about being on the program, but he's really, really busy, and we haven't really worked that out, which we'll do. Oh, by the way, really quickly, I'm not just losing my train of thought here, but January 7th, let me double-check this. I want to announce this to make sure. Where is my cursor? That's one problem having four monitors. Yes, January 7th, 11 a.m., dividing line. You will want to be here. Very, very important. Dr. Michael Kruger, president of Reformed Theological Seminary. Just wishful thinking there. Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, putting out some of the most amazing scholarship today. Great stuff on the canon of Scripture. Remember I told you I contacted him a couple months ago? Last month, I had listened to a Catholic Answers call with a Lutheran on the subject of sola scriptura. I sent it to him and said, we really need to talk about this. And he agreed, but he's a busy guy. And so we had to schedule it all the way out to next Tuesday in the morning with Dr. Kruger. So I hope you will be listening for that. It'll be great. Anyways, I go back to what I was saying here. I talked to the author of the paper, and maybe it'll be time to try to contact him again, see if we can get him on the program. We can talk about his understanding of that particular phrase, the God of this world. But look at the end of that verse. So that they might not see, and that's where the direct parallel, by the way, to John chapter 12 is. So that they might not see, the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. It was that phrase, together with the end of verse 6, that I just made some initial observations on. I honestly think there's such depth here that all I can do is point you to it and say, you know what, with all the stuff that we're doing about 2014 and, you know, making New Year's resolutions and all that kind of stuff, which I don't think is bad, by the way. I think it's good to have times in the calendar where we are encouraged to improve ourselves and to improve our commitment to Christ, look back upon what God's done in our life in the past year and see where things weren't as good as they could have been and where we didn't actually fulfill the resolutions we had and how we can do better in the future. I think those are good things. I'm not one of those people who's going, don't even bother that kind of stuff. But I don't think we could do better in 2014 than to just simply try to plumb the depths of what's said here, and I don't think we could get it done. The light of the gospel of the glory of Christ is the image of God. Now, both here at the end of verse 6, you just have this long line of genitives. And that's why there's a lot of different interpretations, a lot of different ways of understanding it. Because if you've studied the Greek language past first year, past second year, into where you really get, you finally understand the various syntactical categories you get in second year, and now you're starting to actually put them together and doing enough translation to where it starts making sense in third year. There's all sorts of different ways of understanding the various possibilities in this type of expression. But a couple of things I just pointed out to people, just to get to your mind thinking about it. In both expressions, we have the term light. One is the light of the gospel. One is the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. Now, in verse 6, it's really emphasized because it says, for God who said light shall shine out of darkness. Now, that's not a direct quotation of anything from the Greek Septuagint, the Old Testament at all. Is it a paraphrase of Genesis 1? Could be. But if you've looked up light in the Old Testament, boy, there are a lot of references to light. And there's a lot of references to light in connection to the ministry of the Messiah as well. So, given that the specific application is the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ, could it be the light dawning because of the coming of the Messiah? There's numerous possibilities. But light is absolutely central here. And certainly in our day and age, with the darkness that is around us and our being called to be salt and light, to be light, to give that light in the midst of darkness to people who need it, salt to be a preservative, to slow the process of decay that we see all around us. But also remember, this is Paul speaking, and anytime you talk about light with Paul, you got to remember the road to Damascus. Got to remember the road to Damascus. Knocked off his animal by a light from heaven, and he says he saw Jesus. So you talk about the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. He saw that face. That glorified, resurrected Lord appeared to him on the road to Damascus. And what was the result of that? He was in darkness thereafter. Oh, how incredible that conversion was. To be on your way to kill more of God's servants and have the Lord himself intercede and completely turn you around. A lot to think about there. But notice something else. The progression in verse 4 is the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. And then the other one, it's give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. It goes the opposite direction. Is that significant? I think at the very least it's significant in the sense that the Apostle Paul very often, New Testament writers as a whole, but Paul especially, very often we'll simply switch back and forth, you know, the word of God, the word of Christ, glory of God, glory of Christ, spirit of God, spirit of Christ. These are synonymous. And the fact that they are synonymous demonstrates, I think, without much question, what Paul is thinking when he's talking about Christ. And I don't know how Unitarians, I mean, Unitarians would just have to, I don't know, really strip this text of its meaning. One thing is for certain, my friends, one thing is for certain, and may I use this as a basis for exhortation to any of my fellow believers who may be tempted, as I, to lose heart in light of the vicious opposition of unbelief in our day. I mean, y'all know that when's the Rose Parade? Tomorrow? New Year's Day, isn't it? I think it is. I don't watch parades, I'll be honest with you. I did when I was a kid, and after you saw the same balloon for the 47th time or whatever, it's just sort of like, whatever. But y'all know about what's happening tomorrow in the Rose Parade, right? You heard about this? When I talk about the opposition in the world, gay couple to marry on Rose Parade float. So they are going to shove their profaning of marriage into the face of every man, woman, and child watching that that Rose Parade. May I suggest doing something else tomorrow? If you're in Southern California, don't bother going. And if you do turn on that that square thing, find something else. Find something else. Disgusting. But in the face of that kind of in your face opposition, we rejoice in ungodliness and we demand that you rejoice in it with us. In light of that kind of stuff, may I point out that in verse 4, so they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ as the image of God. There is no gospel without a Messiah who is glorious. There is no gospel without a Messiah who is glorious. And the glory of God is found in the face of Christ. In other words, no deity of Christ, no gospel. That's why you see the liberal denominations becoming nothing more than dead shells of religious social clubs, because they lost the deity of Christ a long time ago. And once you lose the authority of the Word of God, you're going to lose the Trinity, the deity of Christ, the resurrection, the atonement. It all just becomes metaphor and the like at that point anyways. But without the highest view of Christ, you do not have the gospel. You don't have it. But beyond that, the gospel is light. Isn't it amazing how many people in our day, in the church, are drawing back on proclaiming the fullness of the gospel, which includes the lordship of Christ, which includes the claim, Jesus Christ is Lord of every nation on earth, and every nation will stand to be judged by him. They draw back on that because, well, we don't want to offend people. But that's the only power that's been given to the church. And so, if you want to be light in the darkness, the only light we have is the gospel. All of the gospel, not just parts of it. All of the gospel, including the lordship of Christ, including the fact that he rules the nations with a rod of iron. If you don't have that, you don't have the gospel. Then notice there's knowledge involved. Verse 6. God is the one who has shown in our hearts, just as he has blinded those that are perishing, and there is no light that is given to them. Remember, the giving of light is an act of mercy and grace. For us, God has shown in our hearts. Not because we deserve it, not because we are better than anybody else. God is the one who can choose how to express his mercy and grace. And so, the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. Knowledge. Yeah, that terrible word, gnosis. Now notice, this is just the opposite of how the Gnostics understood knowledge. For the Gnostics, you gain this knowledge bit by bit by the things you did, by the ceremonies you went through. You sort of climbed up the ladder, gaining this esoteric knowledge of the things you did. Totally contradicted by Paul, who says, God shone into our hearts. We didn't get this from some outside thing we did. God shone into our hearts the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. In other words, if you don't recognize that God's glory has been revealed in the face of Christ, this is incarnation, folks. This is incarnational theology. There is no gospel without a divine Jesus. Here it is again, here positively stated. And when people say to me, well, you know, you don't have to believe the deity of Christ to be saved. Well, if what you mean by that is that the basic gospel message can be understood by someone who does not have a PhD in Trinitarian theology, yes. If what you mean by that is you can hear the truth of the deity of Christ and the doctrine of Trinity and reject it and be saved, no way. Two completely different things. It's not a matter of perfection of theological knowledge, but it is a matter of willingness to bow the knee before divine revelation. Two different things. Must be differentiated. It also means that to really understand the Trinity, to really believe that God has invaded his own creation, it's a gift of grace. It's a gift of grace. God's the one who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. And you see, what sets Christianity apart from all the religions of the world is the fact that when we say we know what God is like, we can point to one who lived amongst us. And he was the exact representation of the person of the Father. God, in the person of his Son, entered into human flesh. That's why the incarnation is so important. If you don't have an incarnation, you don't have Christianity. That's why I just shake my head in sadness when I listen to my Muslim friends saying, well, if you just give up this incarnation stuff, if you just look at Jesus, that's not Christianity. That's what Yusuf Ismail did. That's what Yusuf Ismail says. We have so much in common. If you just wouldn't go too far, well, the too far is the heart, the essence of the Christian revelation. That's why it's not too far. And to not go that far is not ever go far enough to have actual Christianity. So here's the point, folks. I did not expect to wax long. I'm sorry. But here's the point. The reason that the Apostle Paul does not lose heart, the reason he presses on in the midst of all of the nastiness there in Corinth, and oh, it was nasty. I mean, it was ugly. It was uglier for Paul than it got for me Sunday night and Monday on Twitter. It was nasty, but why does he not give up? Why does he not just throw in the towel? Why does he not just open a tire store in Alaska? Because of the passion that was his, because of what God had done within him. Because he had seen that light. He knew the glory of God in the face of Christ, and he wanted other people to have the light of that knowledge. There's a fire in his bones. And that's why he pressed on. And for you, no matter what your calling is, no matter where God has called you, if you're driving down the road in the truck right now, if you are listening on your break while teaching in school, if you are at home taking care of the children with one of the highest callings God has ever placed upon anyone's life, whatever your calling is, you are going to have to go through trial and difficulty and resistance in 2014. And if you have the same passion, if you recognize that God has shown in your heart and given you the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ, and hence you want those students to know, you want your family to know, your children to know, maybe your husband or your wife to know, then you will press forward and you will not lose heart. And even when you see the gospel and you proclaim it and you see the veil upon people's hearts, that won't discourage you. It'll sadden you, but it won't discourage you because it's really a fulfillment of what the Word has told you is going to be. And so just some thoughts at the start of the program today, hopefully to encourage you in this time as we look forward to 2014. 2013, what a year. What a year it was. Started off in the emergency room in Oakland, California. Not the place where you want to get food poisoning, okay? It's not. Lesson learned, always smell that carton of milk before you drink it. That was my lesson in the beginning of January when I got sick after teaching at Cornerstone Seminary in Oakland, California. Oh, that was that was bad. Then February, wow. Lots of stuff happened in February. We had the debate with Michael Brown at Southern Evangelical Seminary. The debate that didn't take place, where Michael and I were supposed to join up against others, got snowed out, which people in Charlotte will tell you doesn't normally happen. I'll never forget sitting in Chick-fil-A with my Muslim opponent. You could not see the parking lot. You could not see the cars in the parking lot. I had not seen snow like that in forever. And we just couldn't do it. It was too, the ice bowl debate. Yeah, it was great. But then the next week, flew off to Dublin. One of the big things of my life, I'll be perfectly honest. A couple of the biggest things in my life taking place this year. There's no question about it. Ministerially and personally. Of course, Clementine arrived in 2012, but just barely. But when I went to Dublin, that was almost a perfect trip. It really was. It was the right length. Wasn't so long as to just wear you down, where you're always having to sort of conserve your strength and you can't really just put yourself out there because you still got six more debates to do or stuff like that. Perfect length. We put me in the perfect hotel. My dear brothers there in Dublin did a great job. But I got to debate at Trinity College Dublin. And if you've ever been in the reading room at Trinity College Dublin, you know how big that was. And the debates were great. In fact, there, with Adnan Rashid, those two audience question periods were some of the best audience question periods ever in now 135 public debates. Just a tremendous time. Really a tremendous opportunity. Did more traveling this year than I've ever done in my life. I earned my gold, my platinum status, and we actually were close enough to chairman's to have to, it was just financially wise to, I am now a chairman, a level of preferred flyer. Which means that any U.S. Airways employee has to bow in my presence. My wife has not gotten into that, though. And I don't think so. Not going to happen. I went to New York in March and had the opportunity of preaching there. I actually won the recumbent division in El Tour de Mesa. I rode my recumbent bike, which I'm going to be getting onto for the first time since April 6th today, because I need to defend. You know, this next month, so I got to be out there on my recumbent. In April, I was in Hawaii with my good friends there, speaking at the church there in Hawaii. Went up to Omaha at the beginning of May and almost froze to death. What was that? Even they said it was really unusual, but it was so cold. It was, oh. And then I'm looking at my calendar, and it's now full of stuff because, of course, what every Christian needs to know about the Quran came out at that time. And so a radio program after radio program after radio program all over the place. Then in May, went up to the Reformation Montana meeting and debated Justin Lee, the head of the Gay Christian Network. Had somebody at church just last evening come up to me, evening before last, and say, thank you so much for your debate with Justin Lee. We listened to it, and it really helped us to talk to family members. I'm having more and more Christians come to, what do I say to these people? Call themselves Christians, but they're collapsing. They're giving in. They don't know what to say. And it's sort of like, we've been talking about this for a long time. You know, go look at the Matthew Vines response, and you know, we've got hours of stuff we can give to people. Just put a blog post up yesterday morning, again pointing out that picture that I posted. Why is there no marriage there? Because there's no husband and wife. Those are words that have meaning, and it's been taken out. That's why it's not marriage. Not marriage. Zero response. Zero response to that blog post. I even sent it to the guy who posted the picture. Zero response. Nothing. Amazing. Get attacked mercilessly on Eric and Cantor, but zippity-doo-dah on that. That was weird. That was strange. Very strange indeed. So anyways, went up to Montana, did that debate. Then, of course, in June, another awesome opportunity, teaching textual criticism in Berlin and having the opportunity of getting to meet Christian brothers and sisters from all across Europe. And what an encouragement it was. And that, of course, has led to the invitation, which I'm so excited about. I've mentioned it before, of teaching at the seminary in Kyiv, Ukraine. Notice I don't say Kiev anymore. I learned that it's Kyiv. You guys should have told me that. You guys in Ukraine should have told me. It's Kyiv. How did I know that? Because the church that I go to, every December for 14 years now, in St. Charles, the pastor there, Pastor Lee, Dr. Lee, Van Lee, he goes over to Ukraine multiple times a year. And so he said, oh, so you're going to Kyiv? And I'm sort of like, okay. You know how you learn proper pronunciation? You know, I mean, he's been over there so many, 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 many times that I'm going to go, okay, I bow to the greater authority there. But anyways, that time in Germany with the folks there, Christian Anderson and the men there at, I keep trying to get Christian, the guys, on, and we get right up to the point of scheduling it, and then it falls apart. So I need to, Christian, I'm sorry, I need to get back with Christian, because I want to introduce you to the work of EBTC in Europe and have the guys on and talk with them. They're just brilliant folks, and if you are in Europe and you're looking to get some great biblical training, the Evangelical Biblical Training Center, they have more than one center. Next year, Lord willing, I will be teaching for them again in 2015 in September in Zurich. They have a center in Zurich, and so I'll be teaching there. And so just great folks. That was a great opportunity to get a chance to go over there. Then I was over in Santa Fe again in July with Paul Scazzafava and the folks there. I hope to be back there again this coming summer, if at all possible. Visited with the folks in Pryor, Oklahoma in August, and had a great time with them. Went to Atlanta and Dallas in September, and gave the presentation, which I edited out those first 15 minutes. It's always been there, which is nothing, which somebody said last night has now been inserted into the recording of Eric and Cantor's debate in Nebraska. That 15 minutes of silence has been put there. And then, of course, at the end of September, and into early October, London, South Africa. Let me say it again. Rudolf Bischoff, brother, you are so special to me. That trip to South Africa, time in London was great. Got to do the programs with Justin Brierley. In fact, the recording of my program with Yusuf Ismail just aired this past weekend that we recorded all the way back there. But the time in South Africa, absolutely tremendous. Rudolf Bischoff and the gentleman down there, but Rudolf especially, he was pretty much with me almost every single day. Kudos to his wife for putting up with his being gone so much. But my time at Northwest University in Potchefstroom and the debates themselves, obviously, for me, one of the biggest things in my life, the debate inside the masjid in Erasmus and outside of Pretoria. Just amazing. Looking forward to arranging this next year's trip to South Africa. We need to go back. We have opportunities, possibly, to enter into the masjid and other places. There's much more to be debated, many more topics to get into, and there's a willingness, so we need to do it. This is the land of Ahmed Didot and the IPCI, and what we want to do this year, and I would ask you to start praying about your part in this, is London, Johannesburg, possibly Durban, Sydney, possibly New Zealand, home that way, world tour, all the way around. We've got a church in New Zealand that's interested. We've got folks in Sydney that are always interested. We need to start arranging that, working that out. We've got folks in Brisbane as well. So I don't know how we can work it all out. There's only so many flights you can do, and I can only be gone so long. Though I have to admit, I'm getting better at traveling for long periods. Rich just looks at me and goes, you're on a plane for how many hours? And he goes, no, not me, not happening.
I have about a 3.5 hour shelf life in that tube before I start going stir crazy and looking for a door. So, no, we're not going there.
That's what we're looking forward to. But again, the time in South Africa is so incredibly encouraging. The brothers that I met there, Uncle John, just, again, a highlight of my life that I am very, very, very thankful for. Then just a few weeks later, Spring, Texas, Vodi Balcom, up to Vancouver for the Solus Conference and all the wonderful brothers there. I've gotten a chance now to speak down in Tucson a number of times at Faith Community Church down there. Great opportunities. Then, of course, once again, just a few weeks ago, I was in St. Charles with the folks at Covenant of Grace Church. And again, more traveling than I've ever done in my life. And I'll just mention in passing, for the half dozen of you that have expressed an interest in this, if not, you can just tune out for a moment, go feed the dog, floss the cat, whatever you want to do. In the midst of the busiest travel year of my life, I set some pretty ambitious goals for me personally on the bike. Most of you know I do a tremendous amount of my study. Right now, for example, some of you have seen the new book. We've got to get this book. We've got to get this book. This is vitally important. From Heaven, He Came and Sought Her, the new 950-page beast that is a tremendous resource on the subject of just the atonement in general, but particular redemption in particular. In particular, repeating ourselves here, but incredible work. And how am I getting through it? I'm getting through it on the bike. I'm 6 hours into 21 hours, so I've got 15 hours left of listening to do. But most of you know that the preparation I do for this program, listening to debates, listening to books, I do it on the back of a bike. And some of you think that's really weird. Everybody, the single most often asked question is, how do you do that? I've put videos up. I've talked about it before. I've just got to put an FAQ on the front page. I've got to make a video, got to just make it complete and say, here's the link, aomian.org/, then something like two letters, so that I can just say it to folks, because it is, without a doubt, the single most often asked question. How do you listen to books while you're riding? So I need to tell them exactly what headphones I use and the software and everything, get it all out there, because it's really not all that difficult. But I set some pretty ambitious goals. I did the double, triple bypass bike ride in July, which is one of the toughest rides in all of America. And I didn't do as well as I wanted to do. Mainly, well, there was a problem the first day that wasn't my fault. There was a problem the second day that was. Let's just say that when you miss your medication, you don't do your medication right, and limit your heart rate to 134 beats per minute while trying to ride 120 miles climbing 10,500 feet at altitude, not a good thing. Not a good thing. Your heart needs to be able to go a little faster than that. So I have goals for the coming year in regards to that in doing much better. But I completed it. I did it. And the past couple of years, the farthest I've ever ridden in a year was about 8,700 miles. I did one year. I switched my years this year. I went to January to the end of December. I finally switched back to a calendar. I'd been doing it from June to June, and so that messed everything up. There was a period of time a 12-month period where I had done 9,300 miles. That was the most I had done in a 12-month period of time. But for a year, it was about 8,700. And so when I finish my ride today, I will, my goal is, I will reach my goal, Lord willing. Again, if lots of things can happen on a bike ride. A big old dog could run over me today. Who knows? Believe me, I have to dodge many of them, especially on the trails. I will have 10,504 miles. Now, you go, why 10,504 miles for a calendar year? Think about it. That's exactly 202 miles per week for 52 weeks. Now, I wasn't here for 52 weeks, so I did some fiddling around. It's just over 235 miles per week when you put everything into what I was actually home the time I was actually able to be here. And in the process, I climbed 82 miles. Now, that doesn't sound like much, 82 miles. That's 400 and something like 431,000 feet. That'll help you put in a little more perspective. I did a lot of climbing this year. A lot of it was at altitude, Albuquerque, Colorado, above 7,000 feet, Flagstaff, the top of Mount Lemmon. And if you know anything about cycling, you go, did a little climbing there. That's pretty good. Now, there are guys out there my age. It's amazing. I'm on Strava, for those of you who are interested in that type of thing. And I'm pretty consistently in the top 10 in the 50-plus category on Strava. I really am. And it's a worldwide thing. So I'm very, very, very thankful to have that kind of fitness. But I look at the guys who podium each week, and they're doing 450, 500 miles with 30,000 feet of climbing. There's guys in that list that have climbed 1 million feet this year. 1 million feet! I did 431,000, and I'm really happy about that. So there are some animals out there. Of course, none of them were debating in a mosque in South Africa either. And none of them had a book come out or working on another book and stuff like that. So you know, it all evens out. And in the midst of all that, I also rode, R-O-W-E-D, have to spell it because English is a little bit ambiguous at that point. Rode, R-O-W-E-D, on a Concept 2 rower, for those of you who are interested, because it's the perfect complement to riding. You're using the exact muscles that you're weakening, leaning over on a bike in doing rowing. I rode 750,000 meters or 750 kilometers this year, which for a rower isn't all that much. But as a secondary backup thing, it's not half bad. So my goal at the end of this year is to be in the 3 million meter club on the rower because I'm at 2,250,000. So I'm right there to be able to get to 3 million by the end of this year. So I am going to be changing my goals. I'm certainly not going for that kind of bulk miles in 2014, especially if I'm going to be doing all the traveling already. Within the first 2 months, I'll have over 20,000 miles in the air just in the first 2 months this year. So I'm not going there. But I am very, very thankful for not only those who have helped me to do that. There are certain people out there that have provided to me some of the materials that I use to ride. And you know who you are and how thankful I am for them. But I'm really thankful for the health that the Lord's giving me. I mean, I made it through South Africa, and all those hours in a plane, not getting sick. And many of you were praying that would be the case. And one of the reasons I push so hard to have the shape that I have is it really helps your immune system. Even when you get something, you get through it faster and it doesn't debilitate you. I mean, I had a sinus thing going recently. It didn't even slow me down the bike. Yeah, certainly I got off the bike sound like I just coughed. I just smoked two packs for about 20 minutes, but, you know, that goes away. So very, very thankful for those opportunities as well. So 2013 was a big, big year there, too. So 2014, lots of stuff coming up. Lots of stuff coming up. Will the needs diminish at all? No, they won't. No, they won't. I didn't. I just now looked in channel, and the rowing part is getting into the channel right now. And then Fred Butler asked a question here. Oh yeah, what do your Roman Catholic handlers have planned for you this year? Referring, of course. Somehow, for some reason, I forgot to just mention the highlights of the year. My debate with Chris Pinto on his movie. It just somehow didn't enter into my thinking for some odd reason. Oh well. So I'm looking forward to 2014. We certainly need you to stand with us as we continue to seek to do what the Lord calls us to do. And we thank you for all the support you've given us over the years. Now, As you can tell, this is going to be a jumbo edition of the program, because it's already 20 minutes after. We're already 50 minutes into this, and I sort of expected that was going to be a little bit of what's that? If you pedal your feet on the airplane, can you count those miles? No, I really don't think that would be. No, that would not be fair. That would not be
only
fair.
If you actually pedal the airplane,
which really doesn't work on those big, large ones. It would take everybody in the plane pedaling to do that. I think probably in those jets at 30,000 feet. But do need to transition into a discussion of what has happened over the past couple of days, and really not sure exactly how to approach all of this. I need to have wisdom because some of this is just so far beyond the level of absurd that it's difficult for any rational person to address these things without starting to laugh and giving in to the temptation to... so much of it is so ridiculous that just to announce it sounds like mockery. Just even talk about it sounds like mockery, because we are talking about statements and actions on the part of people that are so beneath infantile that you go, well, why even talk about it? Well, I'm actually going to be on a program next week talking about why the Cantor scandal still matters. And I really, for those of you who don't think that integrity in the pulpit matter, if it doesn't matter that the Muslims are laughing their heads off appropriately at the behavior of Christians, at the exposure of bigotry amongst Christians who honestly say, I don't care if Ergun Canner is lying about the Muslims. I don't care about the Muslims. I mean, there is a man who calls himself a pastor in North Carolina. He actually pastors a Baptist church. His name is Timothy Rogers, Ebenezer Baptist Church, North Carolina, who refers to my drinking the Muslim Kool-Aid. And this is a man who could never, ever enter into any kind of rational dialogue with you. It's beyond his capacity. It's amazing. This man's behavior of late, he has demonstrated himself to be just completely disqualified for ministry. If anything over the past few days has been demonstrated, it is that that there are people who are in ministry who are utterly disqualified by their behavior and by their utter disrespect for the Word of God for being in that position. And furthermore, their utter incapacity to reason in a logical fashion. Makes you wonder how they just get through life, to be perfectly honest with you. It's shocking. What has happened the past few days was over the past couple of weeks, we have become aware of more and more of Ergun Canner's activities. Interestingly enough, in the period prior to 2006, most of the stuff that we had had before, he sort of exploded in 2006. So lots of videos were available, things like that. But last week we brought to you information about his appearance at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in 2003 and the fact that he was lying about having debated Shabir Ali and all the rest of that stuff, quoting Shabir Ali. It's amazing how many quotes he has from Shabir Ali for having never met the man. Allegedly quotes in personal conversation with himself. It's always, well, Shabir said this to me. Shabir said that to me. And the only thing that Ergun Canner has ever apologized for, Peter Lumpkin says he's apologized for all of this. That's a lie. And poor Petey Lumpkins doesn't know the difference between a lie and the truth. He can't tell the difference. It's a sad, sad thing. The only thing he said in that 10-day posted apology piece, which was then pulled, which you have to go searching for in archives today, was that he misspoke and he named a certain Islamic scholar, he never even bothered to say it was Shabir Ali, that he had debated. And it wasn't him. It was someone else. Now, he doesn't tell you who it was because there wasn't anybody else. So he was lying in his apology. But his sycophant followers who apply absolutely zero thought to their acceptance of whatever he says don't bother to see that. They don't bother to recognize that they're being lied to again. But he did this more than once. He did it twice in 2007, once in 2003. And so there is no reason to believe that multiple times in the intervening time period, he was claiming to have debated Shabir Ali, whom he has never met, and of course whom he has never debated, because I can tell you right now, Shabir Ali would make mincemeat of Ergun Canner. Mincemeat. I mean, the few times that Ergun Canner has allowed himself to even get into anything close to a debate, wasn't a debate, but something close. Remember when he did the thing with the Rational Response Squad? It was pitiful. It was pitiful. And remember when the deacon or assistant pastor at a oneness church from the sticks turned him inside out on the sonship of Christ? I mean, Shabir Ali would, that would be the only video, that would be as popular a video for the Muslims as anything Ahmed Didat ever did, if it were ever to happen, but of course it never did. So, we brought you that information, so we've been talking about it again. And as a result, obviously, we know that Ergun Canner, I doubt Ergun Canner listens to this program. He has somebody else do it for him. I just think he could. I just don't think he could handle it. Because he knows what I'm saying is true. He knows. And he knows it's difficult for, and I don't know what this is like, but I can imagine it's very difficult to listen to someone that you know that if they walked into your presence, you could never, ever defend yourself against what they would say to you. That must be a very difficult thing, especially with someone who calls himself a warrior. He's always, oh, I'm just, I'm so big and powerful, and I debate everybody, and I'm not afraid of culture and all the rest of this stuff. In fact, here, let me, if we've got this potted up. We just discovered today, I guess this was posted on our Facebook page by someone. Thank you to whoever posted on the Facebook page, that Ergun Canner even spoke at Masters College. This was in, I believe, 2004. So within 2003, 2004, he's at places like Masters College, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, Louisville. He's out there, and his story is morphing and changing, and already the lies are there. You know, like we can prove once again, you know, all I learned about you folks was from television. For example, here's his standard line.
But everything I knew about your country, I learned through television. So the first thing I watched, they would translate it into our language, into Turkish or into Arabic, and we would watch it. And this is how we saw America. The first thing we saw that we got ubiquitously was Andy Griffith.
So Ergun Canner should be able to answer this because it was translated into Turkish or Arabic, neither language he knows by his own profession today. That's another lie. Mr. Lumpkin, that's called a lie when you say something that's not true. It's called a lie. And that's what he just did there. Again, another year, another place, not a misstatement, a lie. But we should be able to ask Ergun Canner. I was going to do this on Twitter. Maybe somebody can do that for us. We've got Max over in Edinburgh, and he's listening on a city bus. Isn't that weird? Isn't that strange? I mean, that's just fantastic. That we've got people listening on buses in Edinburgh. And I just have to say, brother, whatever you do, don't go to the little Mexican restaurant on the road up the high street, because that's not Mexican. I'm sorry. I know Mexican food. I live in Phoenix. And what they had there was not Mexican food. I've honestly never had Mexican food in Scotland. Oh, I'm just thinking about what they called salsa there. And anyways, let's move on. What were we talking about? That really got me off of things. what was I talking about? I was talking about where, oh, yes, truth and Peter Lumpkins, which are really on two opposite ends of the spectrum here. But so he's lying about this. So what I wanted to ask in Twitter, and maybe somebody can do this even before I get around to it. Could someone ask Ergun Canner how to say Barney Fife in Arabic? And everybody's going to say, well, you say names the same way. And any like, no, that's not the point. It's meant to communicate humor. He claimed to have learned English with the subtitles in Arabic and Turkish, which he now admits he doesn't speak either language. So how could you have learned anything? It's just a lie. It's called a lie, folks. That's what it is. But check this one out.
We have been ubiquitous on television shows, ever prescient on these various con things. And inevitably, we run into Muslims who will debate us. They will even come to our churches. They have rushed stages in Sacramento at Arcade Baptist Church. They have, in Springdale, Arkansas, come forward at the invitation to argue. In Atlanta, Georgia, they have protested us. I have very little fear of culture.
He has very little fear of culture, folks. He's a warrior. Now, he won't face me for love nor money. I'll come to Bruton Parker. I can guarantee you, if we got the invitation that said, come to Bruton Parker, and we will have an open dialogue and debate on all of your accusations against me, no holds barred. And if I were to announce that and say, okay, folks, we need to raise the money to buy a plane ticket and a rental car and hotel for me to go to Bruton Parker, and this is, we're gonna record this thing, it's finally gonna be dealt with. We would raise that money in 10 minutes. No question about it. I know this audience. We would raise that money in 10 minutes. So, I'm waiting, but I'm not going to get an invitation from Eric and Cantor. So what happened? Well, anyway, sorry. There's the background. I get home from church Sunday night. Just preached on that text I just did from 2 Corinthians 4. And, by the way, everything I just played for you from the new audio that's been discovered from Eric Cantor at Masters College in the chapel service. That's where that was. And I've already written to folks at Masters to say, please do not allow this to be Cantorized. Because as soon as you play it, they're going to try to get rid of it. And why have they been trying to do this? A lot of people have wondered, why would he bother? You all have got this stuff downloaded, and it's all available. Now we know why. Now we know why. Now we know why. You remember a few months ago, back in the summer, there was a tweet explosion from Eric and Cantor proclaiming his innocence. No, it was only a few weeks before I did the presentation in Lindale, so it was probably around August, if I recall. I've got the dates in the presentation. Well, yeah, we've got folks now. Someone listening from Sao Paulo, Brazil. I flew into Sao Paulo in 2003. Spoke down there at the FIEL conference. So, anyway, I get home from preaching, and Eric and Cantor, first time ever, asked Dr. Eric and Cantor anything. For the next minute, unfiltered answers. You pick the topic, use hashtag BPC, and then questions. Go. He was feeling froggy. Well, obviously, people immediately start asking questions. He was asked, what is your favorite color? He says, translucent. It's the color of the tears of our enemies. We spice our meat with it. Is that a quote from 300 or something? I mean, seriously.
I saw the beginnings of this. The first thing I thought of was, you know, they're down south, and somebody broke open the moonshine after church or something, you know?
Something was going on. Then someone asked, when your life is finished, what would you want others to say of you at your funeral? Said he never bowed to philosophers or cowered at bullies. He refused to let the butcher of Geneva rule our day. Now, one of the things that Cantor and his ilk have tried to do all along to deflect the bright light of truth from his lies is to say this is an issue of Calvinism versus Arminianism. Now, you can get simple-minded folks to go with that. Oh, it's Calvinist, well, you must be wrong. And you know, that seems to be his audience. That seems to be the people that he needs to keep himself going, hiding down the woods there in Georgia, out in the middle of nowhere. He certainly ain't at liberty anymore, let's put it that way. So there you've got the butcher of Geneva rule our day. Then somebody asked if he would ever just get together with me to talk. And we have received clear evidence over the course of the past 48 hours that Eric and Cantor, Timothy Rogers, Peter Lumpkins, as a group, have been doing everything they can to try to dig dirt on me. Now, why would they do that? Well, because they know they have to distract. They can't defend. They cannot defend Cantor's statements. They will not publicly face anyone who has the information in their hands that I have. I can sit here right now, and I can start clicking on stuff, and playing stuff. It's so easy to do.
I cannot be president. I came in 1978 when I.
I came in 1970. No, you didn't. It's a lie. And I can just keep replaying it. And I can replay it from this place and that place and this year and that year. There is no way these people can debate these issues. The evidence is absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt. They can't do it, and they know it. So what happens when you're a dishonest individual, when you're a person without integrity, but you absolutely will not abandon a position? You have to attack the people who are bringing the argument. You shoot the messenger. That's what you do. And so they are trying to find anything to use as a means of distraction. Maybe they realize there's a whole lot more out there that's yet to be discovered. I don't sit around looking for stuff on Eric and Canner. This stuff is brought to me by other people. I'm going to Malaga, Spain in 3 weeks to debate Michael Brown. I am focused upon that and trying to make some progress in the book with Shabir Ali. Okay, that's where my thought process is. Is this a distraction? Yeah, but look, I will defend against anyone the reality that there's nothing I can do about it. I have to deal with this. When you have someone who ran around pretending to do what you actually do, you've got to deal with it. You can't be a part of the cover up. So anyway, we'll get to a little bit more of that later on. So what does Canner do? What's Canner's response? He says, sure, along with his sister at the same table. And then Diana Penn, one of the most reprehensible of Canner's followers, just, oh, unbelievable, responds, zing, baby, booyah! This lady really demonstrates the the fact that even the fair of our species can be just nasty on a level that is unbelievable. Raise the subject of my sister? Yeah. You know, even the Catholics got tired of that about 6-7 years ago. I mean, it was good for a while. It was easy for a while. Well, his sister converted to Roman Catholicism. Her sister's done this, her sister's done that. He's just this terrible, horrible person. But even the Catholics went, oh, man, do we really have to go there? Do we really have to do that? But these folks, there is no depth that they will not plumb in the promulgation of their deception. There is nothing. Nothing. I've told you. The single nastiest things that have ever been said to me have been said to me by Baptists, primarily. The Muslims don't go there. A few atheists might. Some nasty Roman Catholics who, I remember the one guy at the, the Madrid debate? Yeah, remember him? He went there during the audience questions. And he stuck around afterwards, was debating with somebody outside. And I marched right up to him. And he about wet himself. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it. Only the most desperate and vile try to dig this type of stuff up. Because there are people on Twitter going, what is this about? So I even put the link to the lengthy thing that I wrote to my sister and talked about the letter she had sent me, your conversion to Roman Catholicism, all the rest of that stuff. I put that out there. So here, read it yourself. Wow. Didn't know about that. Well, okay, there it is. That was, what, 2000? So we're coming up on 14 years ago. But they will dig anything, and Canner's the one that brings it up. Now, I'm not even going to bother to get into the vile behavior of Timothy Rogers, who then ran with this. But it's Canner who brought it up. It's Canner who brought it up. So you know they're working together. You know that there's communication between these folks. And so Canner brings it up. Then you have, Canner saying, he starts talking about, I guess that's because the 5-point evidence was sad, because someone has said, why don't you repent? Presented by hypers, uploaded by hypers, tweeted by lemmings. Now, remember, people always say, why are you attacking Eric Cantor? Folks, I've provided you with massive evidence of Eric Cantor's lies. I've never said anything about Eric Cantor, even close to the personal, nasty, vile hatred he spews at me all the time. All the time. If you can't see that, you know, there's nothing on Petey Lumpkin's blog asking Eric Cantor to repent of just being one of the nastiest guys on the planet. It is a lie to call me a hyper-Calvinist. And he's going to do more in this. He attacks my scholarship and my education. I mean, he is just personally nasty. I don't have to be. I can just simply let him speak for himself. I can just sit here, click on things, and go,
I was the oldest. My father brought his wives with him. Yes.
Oh, no, he didn't bring any wives with him. That's a lie. That's easy to do. I can just let him talk about himself. It's amazing. So he continues on. It'd be a claw. Someone asked, what would you use as your finisher in a match? Because remember, Cantor is this fake wrestling guy. You know, he thinks the WWE is just this awesome stuff. Not the real wrestling or MMA where, for example, you can snap your leg off. Did you see that? Oh, wow. I saw the 18-second clip, and it was like, which you can translate out of tongues if you'd like to. But anyways, so what would you use as a closing to match? It'd be a claw. I'd call it the 5 points of hate. Remember when he had a alternate cover to the Potter's Freedom, the talk about the Potter's hatred, you know, put together? There you go. Then he says, No, for watch your group upload your vids, present them as unbiased. You guys whine when all denied the validity of your charges. Who's the all? Who is the all who denied the validity of these charges? I'd like to know who they are. Where are their names? Then, here's the quote. And I am absolutely unrepentant. That's in caps, folks. This is typed by Eric Cantor himself. I am absolutely unrepentant of your made-up and already disproven charges from 5 years ago. I can't confess to white lies or white trash. Where do you think white comes from there? There it is. I am absolutely unrepentant. All of you saying, well, he's, you know, Brian Broderson, Calvary Chapel, hello, Earth to Brian, he didn't repent. I am absolutely unrepentant of your made-up and already disproven charges from 5 years ago. I won't confess to white lies or white trash. Well, wow, I would think someone who could be so bold as to say that would want me to come to Bruton Parker. Because if these are made-up and disproven charges, can you imagine how Eric and Cantor's entire reputation would be utterly rescued? By him facing me and disproving everything that I say right in front of cameras. That'd be the greatest thing he could do. He'll never do it because he knows he's lying through his teeth. But how can a man who calls himself a Christian put these words on the internet? I am absolutely unrepentant. I never lied about when I came here. I never lied about my father being a polygamist. I never lied about speaking Arabic or Turkish. I never lied about any of that stuff. Well, how can he say that when we can keep playing things? Well, we continue on. He was asked, were you raised in Islamic countries or in Ohio? And he said, both, as most immigrants do. That's not very good English, but it's Twitter. Both. So he says he was raised in an Islamic country. Which one? Here's what I'm guessing he's doing in his mind. He visited Turkey once. So that means he lived there, well, for at least a few days. And therefore he was raised there. Now, that's not what he said. That's not what he said. He specifically said otherwise.
I hated you.
I hated you. Remember, that's what he said.
That may be harsh. But as Dr. Hayes told you, my madrasa, my training center was in Beirut. Before I came to America, we came as missionaries to you. Anything I knew about Christianity, I learned through misconception and caricature. I knew nothing about you, had never been in a church, had never been...
Knew nothing about you?
How do you do that when you're raised in Ohio? It's a lie! You know he can't. He knows he can't defend it. That's why he's hiding in the woods in Georgia. Now, GPS can find Bruton Parker College. I found it on Google Maps. It's right there. A little road going out in front. I can get there. Trust me. Just let me know. Justin Sinner, our Lutheran friend, said, have you ever thought about coming clean about your years, about years of blatant lies? He says, I would if I had, and after the others repent of slander. What slander? Can you name it? What slander? I mean, I can, you say that my degrees are fraudulent, that I did not do the work that produced the God who justifies and the forgotten Trinity and spend the years doing that. You have slandered me. But you see, I follow the biblical mandates. And though I probably have a much better case against Ergen Kanner than anything he's filed against anybody else, in fact, he has no case against anybody else, I can't do that because I'm under the authority of the Bible, and I have to follow its commands. All right? In fact, I could think of some other folks who would have a real case against Timothy Rogers. Big time. Big time. Open, shut, slam the door. Slam the door. Won't happen because we happen to be Christians, and we follow the Bible, even though these people claim to be Christians, and they don't. And they don't. So what's the slander? What's the slander? Here we go. Listen. Hard to repent for videos made, in all caps, by others. I must trust producers. No one does. Not white. Not one. In answer to why won't you repent? You see why they've been canonizing the internet? Because what they want to be able to say is, well, if you can't find it on the original website anymore, and you're only getting it from them hyper-Calvinists, then it's been altered. It's been changed. Don't worry about the fact that that video shows him preaching at Thomas Road Baptist Church. There's a conspiracy. Oh, yeah. Conspiracy. There's a conspiracy. And so now what you have to believe is that all those people behind those television cameras and all those people in the audiences was all made up. See, what happened is I contacted all my friends over at Masters, and just this morning they made up this audio of him lying.
And they funded it with the Alpha and Omega Empire.
Yeah, the Alpha and Omega Empire that Peter Lumpkins talks about. Yeah. And it's all made up. It's Photoshop. It's the movie magic. That's not really me saying those things. It's them hyper-Calvins. Again, quoting Kanner, again, the most rudimentary question in any search: who produced videos, who uploaded them, and what was the chain of custody? So now we have... Now we have Ergen Kanner actually having the gall to say, those may be my lips moving, but them weren't, well, that's not what I said. I never lied about that. I never lied about my daddy being a polygamist. I never lied about when I came here and speaking Arabic. I never lied about debating all them Muslims. It's just all been made up. I'm being persecuted. Amazing. The level of self-delusion is beyond question. And anyone supporting this man is a deluded person or an ignorant person. One of the two. I mean, people who know, like Peter Lumpkins, they're delusional. They know the facts, and they just twist them. Timothy Rogers, just completely beyond comment. Just so far outside of any kind of meaningful confrontation that it's beyond pen, just vile. absolutely vile, filled with hatred like you would not believe. But so many other people, you know what the sad thing is? All they've only heard one side. They haven't heard what I've got to say. They haven't watched the videos. They just hear one side. And so they're like, oh, what? If he's a former Muslim, those Muslims do attack former people, so maybe they're just all together. Kenner didn't stop. He started the next morning attacking me, saying I have two fraudulent degrees, talking about the Calv. I've dealt with the Calv Islamic group for years. Calv Islamic. See what they're trying to do? Anything to distract, anything to blow smoke. Amazing. Then he says, because I assure you, I will not quit. I will not change. I will not cower. Kanner, you're cowering right now. You're hiding in the woods of Georgia. If you were the warrior you claim to be, you'd be calling this ministry right now and saying, White, get out here. Let's debate. It's about time that we got this taken care of. You won't do it. And you know why you won't do it. You know why you won't do it. So that's what happened on Twitter. And as I said, the backstory that what Kanner started was the Timothy Rogers stuff, which is just beyond the level of disgusting. So this morning, I am pointed to a new article. Petey Lumpkins evidently felt that he was being left out. Because I guess he's not a big Twitter guy. I mean, does he even have a Twitter account? He did make one post yesterday? Oh, he was clapping for the most inane man that we've ever met, Tim Rogers. Okay, good. So he's clapping for the vilest stuff that can possibly be. Okay, all right. check out the Twitter pic. There's Clementine watching Grand Queequee on the that's great. Yep, she's listening very intently too. Thank you, Summer. I appreciate that. I'm going to retweet that so that other people can enjoy that. Anyway, sure miss her. Had her for a week, but has to go home. She'll be walking very, very soon. Let me go very briefly, and I'm not going to push myself. If I go a few minutes over, the world's not going to end. Article posted this morning. Well, actually yesterday, December 30th. I didn't see it till this morning. John Calvin, a real evangelical cover-up by Petey Lumpkins. So what he does, he takes the most biased source on the Servetus affair. It's the very same book that was thrown at me by Dan Barker, the head of Freedom from Religion Foundation, by the way. Not from a church historian, but from an attorney. And, of course, attorneys don't do really good history. But, look, again, the soundness, fairness of any type of material is irrelevant to Peter Lumpkins. The man does not understand the concept of honesty, integrity, truthfulness, anything like that whatsoever. He's just, we've proven that over and over and over again. That's just as clear as anything else. What's interesting is, check this out, James White is the director of Alpha and Omega Ministries, a small and apparently struggling apologetics ministry located in Phoenix, Arizona. Then there's a footnote. And if you go down to footnote number one, you discover that Petey Lumpkins has been poring over our financial records. Now, isn't it interesting? Two things to point out. Point number one, they always say I'm the one obsessed with Eric and Kanner. I've never even thought about getting and trying to track down Eric and Kanner's financial records. I mean, I bet he made some big money lying to people. I bet he's made big money off of books that have references in them like Hadith 9:157. But I haven't gone there. And in the time period since the Kanner debate began, the scandal began, look at all that we have done in the area of Islam, in the area of Roman Catholicism, in the area of Mormonism, in the area of textual criticism. But I'm the one that gets accused of being obsessed when it's clear that it's Peter Lumpkins and Timothy Rogers and Eric and Kanner who are obsessed, and they're obsessed with me. They're going through my ministry's 990s. And what's interesting is he's gone through and he's talked about where did all the up and down stuff go? Didn't you read that this morning?
It's been changed. Yep.
There was a guy who was posted on the comments section basically saying that he, you know, applauded his research and that his research is improving. However, point number one doesn't help his overall case. So maybe he...
Yep. I took the footnote down because the commenter made a valuable point. The footnote seemed to deter the overall force of the post. Petey, thanks for taking it down, but it's irrelevant. You posted it. And there was a reason why you posted it. And the internet never forgets. Thankfully, I saved the original on my hard drive. What the original footnote was talking about where the income comes from and decreases and all the rest of this kind of stuff. Folks, let's be real simple here. We're a small ministry. We always have been. Secondly, he says this is because of Cantor. Has nothing to do with it. You want to know why there might be less income now than there was 2 years ago? It's real simple. I've been focused primarily upon Islam. And if I did Radio Free Geneva every week, you wouldn't see that. Just simple.
Well, there's a few things that go into that equation as well.
Oh, there's
called
there's,
a, yes. You know, an economic collapse of the country. And
there's lots of things that go into it, but the fact of the matter is Cantor has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, I don't talk about money. We are the world's worst marketers. Let's just be honest. You listen to almost anybody, unless the ministry is funded by some huge church that has millions and millions of dollars, you hear so much more about money from other people than you ever hear from us. We are a nonprofit organization. We are dependent upon churches and individuals, and yet we never have enough. But because of what we do, we can't talk that much about it because that's what folks would focus on. What if those numbers were huge?
Yeah.
What if they were big?
What if they were like Catholic Answers?
Who, oh, exactly.
You know, we're talking about, what, $3 million?
Exactly. Exactly. What we would hear is how we're making money off of this.
Profiting from it.
Exactly.
Which I think was the guy's point of, hey, this isn't making your point here.
You're darned if you do and darned if you don't. In other words, we're willing to sacrifice to speak the truth here. And he didn't even seem to recognize.
I do have a confession to make, though.
Yes.
And, You know this, but the audience may not realize that I'm the ministry torturer. Uh-huh. There's a place over in the bunker where I torture pennies.
Before we let them go.
Before we let them go and make them scream.
That's right.
And but honestly, we've always been a shoestring ministry and it's simply been the method by which God has seen fit that we do what we do.
Yep.
But at the same time, no one can point at us and say, you're doing this for the money. You're doing this for the notoriety. You're doing this for, you and I were called to ministry you before me. And this has been what God has called us to. And there have been times and long periods of time where there was no money.
Oh, exactly. Oh, goodness,
no
yes.
money. I, you know. And,
oh, I wish you'd look at 990s from the 1990s if we had such things. I wish you would.
But at the same time, the fact that those 990s are out there, there is no rug here where we're sweeping stuff under it.
Exactly right.
All right? It's an open book.
We ain't running around on the internet canterizing anything I've ever had to say anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, if he wants to go, if anybody's interested and look at the stuff you wrote about the degrees.
Oh, yeah.
It's still after all these years, 1997, you put it up there, and it's still up there.
Yep, yep, yep. No, no two ways about it. It must just drive him crazy. But so we are an apparently struggling ministry, all based upon allegedly dealing with Aaron Cantor. He says, I have a narcissistic infatuation. He says, I listened fairly regularly to White several years ago, but grew tired of what I perceived to be a narcissistic infatuation with his personal accomplishments, not to mention his patently unique apologetical method of making those who disagreed with him out to be liars. Well, actually, if an honest person, and P.D. Lumpkins is not honest. Remember when he changed what he put on the video, what he put on the screen was different than what I actually said in the audio as it was fading out? That's dishonest. When you do an entire video where I allegedly am talking about how the love of God's a dangerous thing, and then you ignore what I actually said, that's not honest. So there are some people we have to identify as being dishonest because they're liars. And Petey Lumpkins is one of them. That's just been a fact. But you listen to when I'm debating a Muslim, when I'm debating an atheist, when I'm debating a Mormon. That's not the apologetic methodology that we use. Even when we have corrected a misunderstanding on someone's part and they repeat it, I am loath to go to the extent of saying that this person knows the truth and they're purposely suppressing it. This is not true. So the whole article is just one huge spin machine. Does he answer a single one of the documented things that we have provided? Of course not. He can't, and he knows it. All you say, well, Norman Geisler said Eric Cantor is okay. Who cares? Has Norman Geisler answered any of these questions? No. The excuse sheet not only has been edited itself, but it is absurd on a level that no one could ever defend it, which is why Norman Geisler won't defend it. And he won't send any of his other people out to defend it, because it's indefensible. And you know that, Peter. You know it. So what does he do? Well, Petey decides to continue along the line, which clearly they decided to do long ago. Make this a Calvinist, non-Calvinist issue. Let's attack John Calvin. What he does, he draws from a single source. Does he draw from balanced historical sources? No, he does not. But he goes after Servetus. And someone posted the, what is that funny site on the web? It's not the, what was it? Sandwich, some sandwich sign thing. What is it? Sacred Sandwich, where you have the two guys arguing Calvinism and Calvinism and Arminianism, and the one guy will say, John 6:44, and the guy will say, 1 Timothy 2:4. And finally, in the last two things, the Calvinist goes, Romans 9. And the Arminian goes, Servetus! And then the next screen is, sorry, I panicked. You can always tell. None of these people are historians. None of them would ever survive being placed in their own historical context. It is so unfair. It is so grossly unfair to go after Calvin in this way, and to try to cover for a liar doing this. It just, the dishonesty level broke my meter. It's just reprehensible. But the funniest thing about the whole thing, and I'll wrap up with this because we're already over time. The funniest thing about all this, the first class I ever taught after graduating from seminary was at Grand Canyon College, and you could actually find out for yourself what this is the case, was church history. And that's what I'll be teaching in Kyiv coming up in February. And one of the movies that I showed in that class and introduced, did a whole introduction to, and I was going to do this. Oh, drat. I was going to bring it in and show it. And I can't. That's a bummer, because I was going to show it to the camera. But I went through The Reformers and Their Stepchildren by Leonard Verdine. Some of you have seen the book. My copy is signed by Leonard Verdine. He was about 97 years old when he signed it. I went out to Apache Junction, Arizona, when I found out he lived out there, and interviewed him many, many, many years ago. It was about, what, 94, 95, somewhere around there. Anyway, what I would do, one of the movies I would show, and I'm showing this movie tonight at church. And you can, in fact, you can listen to the recording of my sermon because I mentioned it. So long before the Twitter explosion, long before Petey Lumpkins put up his, ooh, let's go after John Calvin as if this is somehow relevant, which it isn't. Any logical, rational person would be going, what are you babbling about? But again, that's the nature of Cantorism. It destroys all rational thought. You can demonstrate. That I can demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that I already announced the movie that I'm showing tonight for our New Year's thing at church is called The Radicals. Ever seen The Radicals? Radicals is a great movie. Oh, yeah, the production value is from the 1990s and the Mennonites put it together. Okay, so it's not. But if you can get past that, which is not difficult to do, there's some good acting in it, actually. It's the Michael Sattler story. It's a story of the persecution of the Anabaptists. And anybody, and I know Lumpkins isn't going to do this, but anyone who has listened to me teach on church history knows that I've said over and over and over again, Calvin would have had me banished, if not executed, from Geneva. I know that. But only a person who cannot think straight thinks that's relevant to the subject of Calvinism, which goes back to Augustine and Paul. There are some idiot Arminians in the world. That doesn't make Arminianism wrong. There are some idiot Calvinists in the world. That doesn't make Calvinism wrong. Anybody who thinks it does can't think straight. That's the problem. And so I have been clear over and over again. I know that Calvin would disagree with me on a number of different issues. Has nothing to do with the truth or error of Calvinism. No one's covering up for him. I've shown this film I don't know how many times. So the title of the thing, John Calvin, A Real Evangelical Cover-Up, only shows the abject ignorance of P.D. Lumpkins and anybody who will read his material and follow it. That's why if we open up the phone line right now, these people would never take advantage. We've done it many times. Because they know they cannot face someone who knows the truth. I don't know what it's like. I just pray for their repentance. I pray for some of them for their conversion, because it's becoming very patently obvious to me. A number of these people, they're just not converted. That's why they can lie and lie and lie and lie, because, well, Romans or John chapter 8, Satan's the father of lies. But when you can look at the truth and squint so hard, I don't see that, but what about this over here? Survey this! Amazing. You've got to stop. Well, what did Paul say? Don't love the truth. That'll cause you to love a lie. Why is it important? Because there's a man who continues to be asked into churches where there are true believers. He is a deceiver. He presents falsehoods. What was really sad, once we play the 2003 stuff from SBTS, he was asked meaningful questions. Did I play this? I did play this before. I played it last time. He was asked meaningful questions about how to interact with Muslims, and you listen to the response and go, what? It meant nothing. It was, he doesn't know what he's talking about. That's vitally important. The Muslims are watching. They do know there are some of us. We may be few, but there are some of us. We're standing with the truth, and we care. And we're the ones, interestingly enough. Isn't it fascinating? Once again, Aaron Cantor ran around the United States pretending to do something he never did. And he pretends to be something to this day. He pretends to be the warrior, won't be cowered by bullies. Well, let me talk to you about bullies, Timothy Rogers. But we won't cower before them. I'm not hiding in the woods in Georgia. I'll come to your woods in Georgia, Mr. Cantor. I'll come there. And we'll see what the truth is. Shall we do that, sir? Give us a call. You can even call toll-free if you'd like, 877-753-3341. We'll pay the phone number, the charge. You call, and we'll arrange it. How's that sound, Dr. Ergen Mehmet Cantor? The warrior man. So anyways, that was what happened over the weekend. And again, just this morning, more audio discovered, played you some sections of that. So we will not be cowered. We will not be told to shut up. We will press forward in 2014. And we can actually walk and chew gum at the same time, which means this is not the only thing that we're going to be involved in. We have so much going on. As I said, right now, looking forward to the debates with Michael Brown on both, are there healers in the church today, and on the extent of the atonement. Those will be recorded and played all across Europe this coming in just a matter of weeks. So that's where a lot of my focus is right now. Would appreciate your prayers for that. But at the same time, we will not back up. We will not give up. We will stand for integrity in the ministry of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a safe New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. We'll see you later in the week. God bless.